This is Jeff Blankfort welcoming you to the October 10th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. As many as 93 Palestinians in Gaza were injured, 37 with live fire a week ago Monday, during an effort by Gazans to extend the months of protest at the Israel-Gaza border to the Gaza shoreline. When a number of fishing boats set out to sea in what is recognized as Gaza's territorial waters, backed by an estimated 7,000 Gazans on the beach, they came under fire with live rounds from the Israeli Navy. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, medics and ambulances were also targeted by the Israelis, who have killed or wounded a number of clearly marked medical personnel since the middle of March. That's when the Gazans initiated weekly marches and protests at the border with Israel every Friday in what they call the March to Return, a reference to the homes and villages in Israel from which their families had either fled or been forcibly removed at gunpoint 70 years ago. Then last Wednesday, Israeli soldiers kill a Palestinian boy, shooting him in the head with a high-velocity gas bomb while wounding 25 others during protest near the Eretz Terminal crossing, now closed in northern Gaza. The boy, 15, was shot with a gas bomb which struck him directly in his head, lodging in his skull. A video shows gas pouring from the skull as a group of young men rushed to help him to an ambulance. The Israeli soldiers also targeted a Palestinian ambulance with a gas bomb and several live rounds near the crossing. The U.S. media ignored the story, as it has been largely downplayed, the dire situation of the Palestinians in Gaza, who have been subjected to three brutal wars by Israel over the past decade, combined with a suffocating blockade which has led a number of international observers to describe the Mediterranean coastline strip as the world's largest outdoor prison. Israeli snipers, protected by several layers of border, have killed at least 145 Palestinians and wounded several thousand, many with a new specially destructive bullet, since protests began in late March. Over that time, there has been one Israeli soldier killed, shot dead by a Palestinian in August. It has been 13 years since then Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon withdrew Israeli military and approximately 8,500 Jewish settlers from Gaza, the apparent goal of which was to cause divisions between the West Bank and Gaza and solidify Israel's control over Gaza, while giving its people independence from Israel in name only. In other words, Israel would maintain control of Gaza's borders with the collaboration of Egypt in the south of its airspace and its fishing waters beyond 3 nautical miles. When Hamas won the Palestinian elections the following year, Israel began a land and sea blockade of the strip that has lasted to this day, with Israel border officials determining what materials of any sort can be brought into Gaza and who is allowed to leave Gaza for any reason. Under those circumstances, the UN and international community, apart from the United States, still consider Gaza to be Israeli-occupied territory. As for the U.S., while they may have differed sharply over the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, both Democrats and Republicans have been united in backing Israel's bloody attacks on the largely peaceful protesters in Gaza who carry no weapons, endorsing Israel's claim that they have only acted in self-defense. To underscore that point, I should let you know that last month, both the House and the Senate, by voice votes, approved the first of 10 $3.8 billion annual installments for Israel so that it may purchase U.S. weaponry, part of a deal negotiated by President Obama before he left office. I was unable to find a single word about it in the U.S. media, and you certainly didn't hear it about it on NPR. In 2004, the year before Israel's withdrawal from Gaza, I was there with a small group organized by the Berkeley-based Middle East Children's Alliance. One afternoon, we were fortunate to have a meeting with Dr. Iyad Sarraj, a well-known Palestinian psychiatrist whose old friend Yasser Arafat, we learned, had him arrested 3 times over Sarraj's public criticism of the Palestinian Authority and the Oslo Accords. The conversation, which took place in Gaza City, has never been aired before, but what Sarraj, who passed away in December 2013, had to say about what Israel's occupation had done to Gaza society, to the family relationships, to Gaza's children and the prospects for their future, is sadly as pertinent and compelling today, 14 years later, as it was then. That's what you'll hear today at approximately 20 minutes past the hour. The big news yesterday, in the U.S. at least, was that Washington's ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, had resigned, leading to speculation that she may be planning a run for the presidential nomination in 2020 should Trump not be on the ticket, or perhaps as Pence's vice president. Her resignation was greeted with dismay by the pro-Israel Jewish establishment and Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. Haley, quote, was beloved in the pro-Israel community, including the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, which she addressed during its annual policy conference this year, wrote Ryan Torok in the Jewish Journal of Los Angeles. We appreciate the strong leadership of Nikki Haley at the UN, APAC tweeted following Haley's announcement. Thank you for consistently standing up for America's interest and our democratic ally Israel, end quote. During Haley's 20-minute speech earlier this year at APAC's annual convention, she received a dozen standing ovations. Haley's speech there, like that of all the other high-ranking U.S. officials, received no coverage in the U.S. media, although they were broadcast on C-SPAN and can still be found there. In response to Haley's announcement, American Jewish Committee, the foreign policy arm of the Israel lobby, also tweeted, quote, "We will miss her fearless voice," end quote. David Makovsky, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, an influential think tank formed by APAC in 1985, and once a guest on Takes on the World, believe it or not, said that Haley's rhetoric about the UN holding Israel to a double standard, coupled with her star quality, will make her difficult to replace in the eyes of Israel supporters. Which should make one wonder whether or not Israel should have been paying at least half of Haley's salary, or if she should have been forced to register as a foreign agent. Monday's New York Times carried an interesting story that you probably haven't heard headlined. A new wave of Democrats tests the party's blanket support for Israel, end quote. The article described how, quote, a cluster of activist Democrats, most of them young, most of them cruising toward House seats this fall, has dared to breach what has been an almost inviolable orthodoxy in both political parties. Strong support for Israel, raising the specter of a crack in the Democratic Party that Republicans could use to attract Jewish supporters, end quote. The Democrats testing the boundaries of what the Times describes as, quote, the politically acceptable position on Israel in the mainstream parties, end quote, include Ihan Omar, a Somali-American Muslim running for an open House seat in Minneapolis, Rashida Tlaib, a Palestinian-American Muslim running in Detroit, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez running in a heavily Democratic district in the Bronx and Queens, and Leslie Coburn, co-author of Dangerous Liaison, the inside story of the U.S.-Israeli covert relationship, and sister-in-law to the late columnist Alexander Coburn, who is running in a Republican-leaning district in Virginia. Tlaib, a veteran Michigan state legislator, initially supported a two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict, but has since moved to supporting a single state for both peoples. It has to be one state, she said. Separate but equal does not work, end quote. Omar, who had criticized Israel's, quote, evil doings in 2012, was accused on Twitter of anti-Semitism after her campaign got underway. Drawing attention to the apartheid regime, she said, is far from hating Jews. Brad Sherman from the San Fernando Valley, a leading pro-Israel voice in the House, admitted that, quote, I do worry that there are some on the extreme left of our party who adopt slogans, end quote, that are creating tensions. Ron Halber, executive director of the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Washington, D.C., dismissed the newcomers as a fringe with little influence. We're talking, he said, about a handful of people. They're certainly not going to move Congress's wall-to-wall support for Israel, end quote. His greater concern, he said, is that Trump's friendly relationship with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is getting Israel's narrative, quote, caught up in the anti-Trump fervor, which is not fair for Israel, end quote. Neither Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, a staunch supporter of Israel, nor House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, who may be only slightly less so, responded to the New York Times request for comments. The pro-Israel-Palestinian candidate's leanings, the paper pointed out, appear to align with a broader consensus among Democratic voters. 2 years ago, Democrats were more likely to sympathize with Israel than with the Palestinians by a 14 percentage point margin, according to a Pew Research Center poll. In January, the same Pew poll showed the cap has shrunk to 2 points. That's significant and the first time I had seen that reported. Matthew Brooks, executive director of the Republican Jewish Coalition, accused Democratic leaders of failing to push back against the, quote, hostile remarks from Democratic candidates. Said Brooks, that involves policing and enforcing their own and making clear that these views are outside the mainstream. So far, they haven't done that, he said. It should be quite clear that Donald Trump's appointees to virtually every cabinet or foreign policy position, not to mention the Supreme Court, have been the worst of any sitting president, but who could have thought, or would have thought, that it would be former Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson, his envoy to NATO, who would be the one to openly threaten war with Russia. Last Tuesday, ahead of a NATO defense ministers meeting at the alliance headquarters in Brussels, Hutchinson told the world's media that Russia must halt its covert development of a banned cruise missile system, or the United States will seek to destroy it before it becomes operational. The U.S., which has embarked on a trillion-dollar program to update its nuclear weapon system, claims Russia is developing a ground launch system in breach of a Cold War treaty that could allow it to launch a nuclear strike on Europe at short notice, a charge that Moscow has consistently denied. Hutchinson said Washington remained committed to a diplomatic solution, but was prepared to consider a military strike if development of the medium-range system continued. At that point, she said, we would be looking at the capability to take out a Russian missile that could hit any of our countries. Countermeasures by the United States, she said, would be to take out the missiles that are in development by Russia in violation of the treaty. They are on notice, she said. So, I would say, are we. In case you might have missed it, Sunday marked the 17th anniversary to the day when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan to depose the Taliban, and on that day at least 54 people, that Sunday it is, 54 people were killed, 35 members of the country's U.S.-trained security forces, and 19 civilians. Local officials said the majority of the civilian deaths had occurred as a result of firing by government forces in the central part of Afghanistan and by U.S. airstrikes in the eastern part of the country. As could have been expected, spokespersons for the U.S. military, who have been known to have a penchant for lying in these situations, denied that it had conducted airstrikes in the area. The New York Times reported that there are no tangible signs of momentum for peace talks with the Taliban, who, it should be remembered, never attacked us and offered to turn Osama bin Laden over to U.S. forces if Washington provided proof that he was responsible for the attacks of 9/11. The Bush administration preferred war, and those later accused of masterminding the attacks on that day sit in prison in Guantanamo in the U.S.-occupied portion of Cuba, awaiting a trial that will most likely never take place. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.